I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. Please come along and join me for a fascinating interview with Major General Laura Yeager at Camp San Luis Obispo, recorded May 13th, 2022, one day before her retirement ceremony at Camp Roberts, following 36 years of active duty service. Trailblazer General Yeager was the first female to lead an Army Infantry Division when she took command of the 40th Infantry Division based at the Joint Forces Training Base, Los Alamitos, California. General Yeager began active duty service after receiving her commission as a second lieutenant in 1986 from the Reserve Officer Training Corps at California State University, Long Beach. She completed military helicopter training in 1989 and then served as a UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter aeromedical evacuation pilot. In 2011, she deployed to Iraq as the deputy commander of the Guard's 40th Combat Aviation Brigade, and she began making history a year later when she was named as the first woman to lead Joint Task Force North Northern Command at Fort Bliss, Texas. Major General Laura Yeager, who's the commander of the 40th Infantry Division. How awesome.
Yes. A couple more days anyway.
Yeah. So you're coming up on retirement.
That's true. Yeah. After 36 years of service.
Wow. So Fountain Valley High School, did you ever in your wildest imagination visualize yourself here, a two-star general?
I never imagined. I'm the daughter of a National Guard officer myself.
Uh-huh.
He's passed away not that long ago, but he retired as a major general himself. So I grew up in a home where there was military service present, and yet it never occurred to me when I was in high school that this would be a career choice for me.
Oh, interesting. So what did you think you were going to do?
I really had no idea what I wanted to do, but I was very interested in biological sciences, and we didn't have a lot of money to spend on my college, so I knew that I would need to live at home and commute. I looked within the radius of where my home was, and I decided that UC Irvine would be a good choice for me because they had a great reputation in biological sciences.
Mm-hmm. Did you join ROTC? How did the military connection come in?
After my first year, my parents told me that they would not be able to continue to afford that school, even though it was very reasonably priced back then. They wanted me to move over to Cal State Long Beach, where my sister was attending college. But by that time, I was already familiar with the campus. I really wanted to stay. It just so happened that I saw a flyer on a bulletin board advertising ROTC. And at the time, there was a $100 stipend per month. And that would be enough money to make up the difference between the tuition at UC Irvine versus Cal State Long Beach. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'll give this a try and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So that was Army National Guard that you signed
up? Army National Guard,
uh-huh.
Yes. Well, at that time, when you join ROTC, you don't know where you'll end up. You could end up active duty in the reserves or in the Guard. And I was just looking for the money to help pay for school at that point.
Little did you know.
Little did I know.
Yeah, 38 years later.
Yeah. I joined and went to camp. That was after my freshman year. And just fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. It was so different from anything that I had been doing. I loved the adventure, learning how to fire weapons and obstacle courses, just the camaraderie of being part of a team of diverse people from all over the United States.
So after graduation from college, mm-hmm. then what happened to you?
Then I actually was commissioned as a second lieutenant and went on active duty, and I was branched Medical Service Corps, which
explain that. Were you a paramedic? You know what?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my father was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he served in the National Guard. Actually, he retired as a major general himself, and he was a helicopter pilot. And
he flew Hueys.
Yeah. And once I decided I wanted to join the military, I became very interested in flying helicopters. And there's two ways to do that in the Army. One is aviation branch, and the other is Medical Service Corps.
Mm-hmm.
My first choice was aviation, which I didn't get, but I did get Medical Service Corps.
So that's equivalent of a medevac?
Medevac.
Okay.
Exactly. Yep. So that was my pathway to get into learning how to fly helicopters.
Was there a moment, flying a helo is so different than fixed wing.
Yes.
You're going every different direction at once. Was it intimidating to you in training and learning how to fly a helo?
I feel like the Army does a very good job with training. There's really a good way of letting the student know what the standards are and walking you through the process. I never really had any doubt that I would be able to get through the school. I've always felt like if one person can do it, so can I.
So once you're up in the air and flying, did you like that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still fascinated. If I see a helicopter flying by, it stops me dead in my tracks.
I am right there with you.
Yeah. There's nothing like the feeling of picking up from the ground to a hover in a helicopter. It's amazing.
You're probably like me. You can just hear the rotor
sound.
Yeah, and you know, Black Hawk.
Yes. The UH-1, the Huey, with the aircraft.
That's what you flew.
I did fly the Black Hawk, later in my career. Mm-hmm. But the sound of the rotor blades, it's like the beating of my heart almost.
I love it. Yeah, you're singing to the choir.
Yeah.
Yeah, I flew on a medevac training mission up at Hunter Liggett.
Yeah.
That was really cool. They're kind of the unsung heroes.
Yes.
You know, they don't get the floodlight.
Yes.
And so I try to focus on those, like military spouses, we'll do a show with those who don't get the spotlight.
Yeah. We have an amazing medevac unit here in California. Actually, our medevac unit, when it was deployed to Afghanistan, this would have been a number of years ago, they did a study on the efficacy of our flight crews compared to other flight crews, because what we had done is we'd recruited paramedics to be our flight medics, so it was a higher level of training. And it turned out that if you were a patient on board one of our aircraft, you had a much higher rate of survival than if you were on a medevac from any other unit. What the Army did after they reviewed this study is they raised the standard for all flight medics to be equivalent to what we had established in our unit here in California. So we were really groundbreaking in that way.
Okay, so then there's more to the Lori Yeager story. You were flying pilot, but then there was a shift in your career.
Well, when I was promoted, so I was very fortunate to have been nominated and deemed a person that could be promoted general officer. So that was definitely a big turn in my life. And I honestly never expected that to happen either. I've always just really been focused on what I'm doing at the time.
Right.
And just do the best that I can at the job that I'm assigned to. You know, I never expected to be a general officer. I never expected to be a division commander. It's not something that I had envisioned for myself. I wasn't sure how long I'd even stay in service. All I knew was I was going to stay as long as the Army would let me and as long as I was enjoying it. And it turns out I've had a wonderful 36-year career.
I know it's hard to talk about yourself, but what makes you an extraordinary commander?
You know, I was talking to my aide, DeCamp, on the way here, and I think I'm a very average person. Mm-hmm. I've always had to really try hard at things, but I understand the challenges that people have. Nothing has come super easy to me. I have a very good work ethic, and I think that makes a difference.
Does that give you compassion for those under you?
Yes, yes. I mean, I definitely understand, you know, what can be challenging, and I think it gives me patience and a certain sense of humility that is helpful.
So at some point you shipped out and you went downrange to Iraq.
To Iraq, yes.
Tell us about when that was and what you did there.
That was really interesting. It was in 2011, and it was around the time that the United States was trying to decide whether we would maintain a presence in Iraq or if we would leave. So while we were there, there was a lot of going back and forth between the United States government and the government of Iraq. And ultimately, it was decided that we would pull everybody out. Mm-hmm. And so being there on the ground and watching all of the challenges and the logistics related to removing all the soldiers, as much of our equipment as we could remove.
The materiel must have been mind-blowing.
Yeah, because we were spread out all over the country, wanting to leave the Iraqis' capability to secure their own country. So it was very interesting to see that from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
From there.
The other end of the land.
From the other end, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, we had a really great deployment. Main thing is we brought everybody home, but we flew thousands of hours all over the country, moving soldiers and material, supporting the troops on the ground. And it was one of the most amazing experiences I've had in the Army. I was so fulfilled to be able to actually do the thing that I'd been training for all my career. We had a great team. In retrospect, I know it was very difficult on my family. And it was about, I guess, a year
that
after
separation.
The separation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, about a year after I return my son, who's now 27. He told me, Mom, that was the worst year of my life.
Oh, wow.
And it just really...
That's painful.
It was really painful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's quite a burden for our families to bear.
Interesting.
Yes.
So at some point, you become the first female division commander in the United States Army, correct?
Yes, that's true.
That's amazing. And I get to talk to you.
Yeah, I never even imagined this for myself. I was actually on a tour at Fort Bliss, Texas, and I'm reading through my email, and a notice came in about a board. For anybody that was interested in becoming a division commander, the National Guard Bureau was conducting a board. And I read through the memo, and I realized that I meet all the prerequisites for this. And I emailed back to General Baldwin, who's the adjutant general here in California, and I asked in that email, hey, sir, I'm thinking about applying for this board. What do you think? And not long after, maybe within the hour, I got a reply from him, and it just said, yes, exclamation mark.
Wow.
And so I threw
right to the point.
Right to the point. Yeah. He's a man. He is very succinct.
Yeah.
And so I threw my hat in the ring, and here I am.
Tell us a little bit, what is a division commander the 40th? You know, what's your primary mission and what's the breadth of what you're responsible for?
Yes. So it's a really interesting time to be a division commander. The last 20 years or so, we've been focused primarily on counterinsurgency operations like we did in Iraq. And those operations were very much brigade-centric operations. Mm-hmm. But now we've pivoted because we have near-peer adversaries in Russia and China, and we have to refocus our efforts on large-scale ground combat operations. So there's a requirement for divisions to be ready to do that, and the division commander is responsible for, obviously, the readiness and the training of the brigades under the division, but being able to employ them in a way that we can defeat our near-peer adversaries using combat power. So a lot of aviation mm-hmm. and a lot of fires. And really, that's the primary.
Fires meaning?
Field artillery.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, obviously managing the logistics and the personnel aspects that go with that as well. Mm-hmm. But we've shifted the United States to back to a point, ironically, when I was first commissioned as a second lieutenant, we were very much focused on the threat at the time, which was the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and being prepared, if necessary, to fight and win in Europe against the Soviet Union. So we're kind of back to where I was when I was a young lieutenant. Interestingly. Mm-hmm.
Huge full circle.
A huge full circle. Yeah. Yes.
So in your time as division commander of the 40th, what sort of training exercises would you focus on and where would you do those?
It's been a really busy 3 years. I mean, as you know, with COVID and the pandemic, there's been a high demand on the National Guard. And within that context, you know, we've been doing a lot of work within the state, wildland firefighting. We also had a very large activation for the civil disturbances related to the George Floyd situation. So we do get a lot of practice doing defense and support of civil authorities, which is good practice for our staffs, mm-hmm. basically, because you have to really do the planning and execution to move a number of people and logistics support for them. But on top of that, we also do exercises that are called warfighters. And they're computer simulations where we basically are able to fight our formations within a simulation against a realistic adversary in the simulation.
And where does a lot of your training take place?
We have done them, warfighters, up in Fort Lewis at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and just finished one on the 14th of April in Fort Hood, Texas. And the division's also done a couple of exercises with the Japanese self-defense ground forces in Japan. So we did a couple of good exercises with them as well. So we've had a lot of opportunities to practice our tradecraft.
And it's interesting to me in that when you deconstruct a military operation, logistics is everything.
Everything.
Right?
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about that, because that's something from the outside people take for granted.
They do. Yes. Yeah. Without the, you know, they say the beans and the bullets, mm-hmm. you know,
your gasoline
and your ammunition, you cannot win without really good logistical support. And it's one of the things the United States Army really does quite well.
And that's one of the things that central to your focus of training, correct?
Yes.
That dynamic.
Yes. So we have two command posts. We have a main command post that's really focused primarily on the employment of the weapon systems And then we have a rear command post that focuses more on the maintenance and logistics for the organization. So that's kind of how we divide things up. And I have two deputy commanders. I have one deputy commander general for operations and one deputy for support. So those two divide up the workload, one focusing more on admin logistics, the other on the operations.
Yeah, and even just physically transporting your Humvees or whatever, I mean, just amazing what goes into it.
It is, and the technology, the communication system, so the command and control systems, being able to talk and move data and keep all the command posts synchronized as to what the situation is in terms of friendly situation and the enemy situation.
So you're commander of the 40th Infantry Division.
Yes.
Implicit is that you have infantry soldiers.
Yes.
Right. So how do the different divisions, how are they distinctive from one another, or are they?
There are a variety of types of division, and the Army is doing some restructuring and some reorganization. Our division, the 40th, would be considered a light division, which means it's got three infantry brigade combat teams. You'll have other divisions, heavy, that have armor brigades, sometimes striker brigades within them.
So you would not have strikers then?
I do not have strikers.
Do you ever wish you had them?
You know, I think that being a heavy brigade would be really interesting. At one time, we did have tanks here in California, and it would be wonderful to be able to get an armor brigade back in the state. But right now, the 40th is considered a light division.
Getting to know you and listen to you, there's this strata that gender doesn't even exist, you know, and yet by default, you are a female.
Yes.
So when you look back and you look at yourself and your career, what difference did it make? What role did it play, or was it a non-starter in the scheme of things?
I think because initially I started in the medical service corps, been a high concentration of females within the medical branches for many years, you know, starting with nurses in Vietnam. Nurses, you know, have always been a big part of the Army, and until recently, most nurses are female. So initially, I was in units where there were a lot of females. So it was not, it didn't feel unusual to me. As I moved up, and when I switched into the aviation branch, I started to be in organizations where there were much fewer women. But, you know, it still didn't really make any difference because the Army is very much a standards-based organization, and they lay out exactly what they expect you to do, and no one really cares what ethnicity you are, what religion you are, what gender, provided you're competent and able to do the job. I think that's what makes it such an amazing organization to belong to.
But there has been a default evolution in the military over the span of your career.
Yes.
And one specific thing I can think of is the role of the female in a combat position.
Yes.
Talk to us about looking back and looking forward and here now.
Yeah, I don't know if as a young lieutenant I would have wanted to branch infantry or gone to Ranger School or some of those other opportunities that are now open to women.
But when you went in, you couldn't do that.
Right, and I wanted to fly helicopters, as I mentioned. I would not have been able to fly an Apache helicopter. That was not open to me as a female.
Wow.
Neither the Kiowa as well, because those were considered combat platforms. I would have wanted the choice. That's what I would say. I would have wanted the choice.
And now you have it.
And now I have the choice. And when you look at the senior leaders in the Army, where they come from is the combat arms. And so the path up to senior levels of leadership really depends on having the opportunity to do those jobs. And so it's going to take a few years for women to matriculate up through in enough numbers so we'll see more females in senior leadership positions. My personal dream is I would love to see a female as the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah.
Then I would know. That's kind of like the last, the last,
last mountain to climb.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
I don't think we're that far off.
No, I don't think we are either.
Yeah.
That female's probably in the Army right now.
Yep.
Yes.
You know it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Grooming.
Yeah. Yes.
So in your resume, looking back, combined arms training,
yes,
you were involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, it was General Hunter Liggett who initiated combined arms philosophy in the military. Talk to us a little bit about what you learned and how that was an evolutionary game changer for you.
Yeah, there. When I was a younger officer, there was a thing called Airland Battle, which was really this idea of synchronizing all of the different platforms and ways to defeat the enemy. Now we're looking at what's called multi-domain operations. So it's air, sea, land, space, and cyber, and really trying to synchronize and get the best effects by combining all of those different capabilities that we have. So basically, any sensor, any shooter is what we say, and staying ahead of the adversary really is what we're trying to do. Speed is really everything.
I've been involved with California State Office of Emergency Services, and I took their 3-day anti-cyber terrorism course. My takeaway is and was that, as you know, there's a game changer in what are the front lines in a military operation.
Yes.
And more so, as you painfully know, it's cyber terrorism.
Yes, cyber is a huge threat. We have very good capability within our ranks, some very talented soldiers and other members from across the armed forces that are very talented. And that is a domain that we really need to have strong capability in. It touches everything.
Unlike World War II, you don't have to invade. You don't have to have a tank armada. All you have to do is take out or electronics,
yes,
and you've shut them down.
Yeah, so we definitely have to be playing a strong defense to make sure that our systems are safe and secure and protected, because definitely the cyber is a threat.
So what is next in Laura Yeager's life?
Gosh, I'm really looking forward to being able to travel and spend time with my family, get caught up on things that I've had to put to the wayside, and just spend probably the first year just relaxing and decompressing. The only thing I know for sure is I don't want to work full time.
Right.
That's the only thing I figured out.
Are you involved in nonprofits or greater good organizations? And
I'm starting to look at opportunities. I'm currently a member of the UC Irvine Alumni Board, so a proud anteater, and going to be doing some work with them, and I would like to find other opportunities to continue to contribute, but still leave some time to do the things that I want to do, the fun things that I want to do.
Dream list, place you'd like to travel to where you've never been.
Well, I would really like to go back to Japan. We were able to do a couple exercises there. Really love Japan. Iceland, really wanting to go to. Want to see the Northern Lights there. The list is almost endless. But my best friend from grade school and I are currently planning a trip to Europe. We're going to hopefully get that going here in August and hit the road.
And how about a little Art Robinson R22 for Laura?
Ugh.
Would you ever consider?
So expensive.
I know.
It's super expensive. I did take a Discovery flight in a fixed wing because I thought, after I'm not flying helicopters anymore, maybe fixed wing, would be something I was interested in. But it just didn't have the same allure, and I was like, no, this isn't for me. If it can't be helicopter, then it's nothing.
I understand.
Yes.
Okay, your turn. Any secrets you're holding back? Whatever you want to share, or what you're most proud of, looking back over your career.
I would just like to put a shout out to people to consider military service. Right now, only about 1% of Americans make the choice to serve in uniform. And it's becoming more and more what you would call a family business. So it becomes a tradition like it is in my family. My father was in the National Guard. I am now. My son is in the Army Reserves, but probably be transferring back to the Guard. And I think that there is a hesitancy among people because they don't understand what service is like. And what's unfamiliar is scary. And I think if they would try it, they would find how fulfilling it is.
In what ways do you feel it is most rewarding and fulfilling?
I've served on active duty and I've served in the National Guard. I really enjoy serving in the National Guard because you can see the impact that you're having on your own community. And people really appreciate when we're on the ground helping them through some of their worst days. So whether it's a forest fire, floods, earthquakes, when they see us, their day just got a little bit better.
I love it. I hate to let you go, Laura Yeager, but you've got a lot to do.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you for having me.
This is my absolute pleasure. We've been speaking with Major General Laura Yeager, the outgoing commander of the 40th Infantry Division. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. And in fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So yes, please support your local NPR station.